It's Song Talk Radio with Michael, Neil, Phil, and the gang.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. We are so glad you could join us here on Song Talk Radio. This is a little show where we talk about songwriting. We share tips and tricks and things we figured out along the way, and you share your tips and tricks, and hopefully by the end, we will all get just a little bit better at writing songs. I'm Phil, and I'll be the key host today, and along with me, as per usual, are my good friends that we talk songwriting with. Over on my left is Mr. Neil Modi. What's new with you, Mr. Neil?
Oh, nothing much new. I'm just wondering why you called it a little show, because last week you told me that we were a big deal.
A big deal. Big friggin' deal, I believe, is the phrase.
No, is that not the phrase you use? Okay.
That's a phrase.
In that case, you're on. That's right.
And of course, Mr. Michael Proudfoot. What's happening, Michael?
Oh, I'm staying busy, staying active. Was out in public today, having a lunch, wandering around with humans, wearing a
People.
Mask still.
Oh.
Yeah.
I can never
eating
mean
out in
good.
Public with humans. It's not going to lead. No, it's going to end in tears for sure.
Oh,
but
I had
a nice double beef, a beef soup, and then a sliced beef sandwich with fried onions on a Kaiser at one of my favorite diners.
Mm. Wow,
so it's very like, good.
I feel satisfied.
Like red meat consumption for a month.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Yes, I'm started to unpack my studio, so things are starting to hopefully sound better.
Oh, excellent.
Cool. Yes, man. Mm. No more accidental reverb.
Mm.
Right. So we've got
now the real stuff.
Yeah, the real stuff. And we've got some stuff happening. Our Song Talk Radio Challenge. It's the third one, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
It is our third annual, and unlike the other ones, this one is different. Well, the others were different too. I think our first one was a positive lyrics with a minor chords, and then it was repeating chord pattern. And this time, it is lyrically driven in that you have to start with the title, "Why Do You Cry," and write a song from that. And you know, we've gotten a lot of submissions, and they're quite good. I would hope that we don't get too many instrumental submissions, because I don't think that that's really the spirit of the thing.
That's true.
I do appreciate any submissions, but I'd like to hear what you do lyrically with a title as well.
Indeed.
And we will be presenting ours. I'm doing okay. I actually have something, which was more than I had 2 weeks ago. So.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for your drum track.
Yeah. I'm still working on it, but yeah.
Yeah, so you need separate stems?
I'd like your separate stems, yeah, vocals, guitars,
yeah,
bass.
I'll send you that maybe tomorrow, actually.
Easier for me to mute stuff.
But I was really happy when I laid down that first track to my rough stuff. It synced up and made it work very nicely. So I'm feeling quite positive about it.
Cool.
Very
got
nice.
Some John
how
Anderson
you,
from Yes, Harmonies.
Nice.
I didn't know I could sing that high.
I've got started, and now
great.
That my life is starting to come back to normal, I feel a bit more positive that I might be able to actually deliver something. So that's always exciting.
And how have you started? Because I know you're always a lyrics last person. So how have you started? I'm curious.
Yeah, I'm
started
curious
with
about that.
The chorus.
Started with the chorus, like the lyrics for the chorus?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
nice.
You worked out a melody around "Why Do You Cry" and went from there?
I actually started off with some words.
Cool.
So.
Oh.
Okay.
Wow. This has been a good challenge for you then, huh?
It's a brand new world for
you
Phil.
You haven't heard it yet. You haven't heard it yet. So.
Regardless of what the outcome
true.
Is, you know, pushing you to write in a different way, I think is always a good thing.
It is, actually. Well,
yeah,
it's so easy just to do the same stuff that you've done all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes. So please send your stuff into feedback@songtalk.ca and just say contest entry or something like that. And yes, we'll definitely
and tell us
play
about your
show.
Journey too. Like how you, like, did you start with the lyrics? So, like, tell us how that song came to be as well. We really like the songwriting process stories.
Yes. Strangely enough.
Funny thing, because this is really a cooking podcast.
That's true. And before we get into our next recipe, we're going to be talking about something really an interesting phenomenon. Do you want to sort of introduce that? Or why don't we actually, we're very excited to actually have a guest to talk about this. He's been on our show before, Mr. Eric Alper. And of course, he is a Canadian music correspondent, blogger, radio host, and former director of media relations at E1 Music Canada here in Toronto. And since 2016, he has run a music public relations company, That Eric Alper, and is the host of That Eric Alper Show on Sirius XM. Thanks for being on the show again, Eric.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I have waited so long to talk to somebody, anybody that would listen on why old Betty Crocker recipes are better than new ones. And what I think it had to do with is the baking trays are now using better aluminum. Wait. This really isn't the cooking show.
No, it's not the cooking show.
No, but I'm curious to know where
I really
this is
want
going.
To hear the end of that story.
Right, right. For cooking asparagus.
Yeah. it's just because, you know, when your mom made food, it just tasted better.
That's
and when
true.
You and when you cut sandwiches diagonally, it tasted better.
They
I don't
do.
Care what anybody has
they
to
do.
Say.
They do. That is very true.
Yeah. So, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be anywhere. I'm happy to talk to you guys and yeah. This is life slowly getting back to normal, I think, for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. So, and absolutely. This is an interesting topic. It's something they say about catalog music, which is outselling new music. Michael, do you want to fill in the details a bit?
Yeah, I think the first, I don't know, call it alarm bells, but the first time this was newsworthy, I think it was back in 2015. That was the first time that catalog music outsold new music. And I've noticed from searching it that this happens periodically, but I think it's not quite as cut and dried as old music. You know, people rather listen to old music than new music. I think it has to do with a number of factors. But I am curious, is this a signal of some massive change? Does this mean that people aren't interested in new music? And I thought, well, how could we figure this out? And I thought, well, our friend Eric Alper would probably know, or at least have a number of suggestions and theories. So is this a reason to be alarmed?
I think if you're a new artist, yes. I think if you're a new artist that's not on TikTok, doubly yes. And I think that, you know, it all depends on what side of the industry that you're on. You know, if you are one of the dozen or so companies that have seemingly bought up every single classic song of the last 60 years to 30 years, you're really, really happy with this. This is why you were seeing hundreds of millions of dollars exchange hands to people like Bob Dylan or Sting, and Paul Simon is now right at this moment negotiating selling his catalog. We've seen Phil Collins get up there in terms of wanting to sell his catalog. So, you know, the ability for that kind of music from, say, 1960 to 1990, that every generation, until we all blow up to smithereens in some nuclear war, are going to be listening to this music forever. Because all these companies want is they want their money back and they want their investment back and they want it fast. So we're going to hear Bob Dylan in television commercials. We're going to see Sting story in Broadway and on, you know, soundtrack work. So I think if you're that side of the company and you thrive on catalogs, I think this is great news. I think if you're a brand new artist, you probably already know that nothing sticks these days. It's really hard for any book, any television show, any movie to really land in the center of America or North America or the world in terms of everybody all consuming the same thing at the same time for a long period of time. You know, there will never be another album like Michael Jackson's Thriller or Nevermind by Nirvana. We're too scattered. And I think that these numbers that were revealed, that catalog sales, meaning music that is more than 2 years older, are seemingly, you know, demolishing the newer numbers in terms of new artists, in terms of new songs, I think is really scary, but it all depends on what side of the industry you're on.
Okay, just for some background, the MRC during across all the whole of 2021, catalog music actually claimed 69.8% of the total album consumption in the United States. Originally, it had looked at 74.5, but the numbers are a little bit different. But that's still a pretty significant change.
Yeah, the point is that it seems to be growing year after year. But I'm curious, Erica, if you have some insight into this whole 18 months equals catalog music. Like, how did, like, is that a reasonable datum line to be setting to determine what constitutes catalog music and what doesn't? Because, I mean, you know, like, we're all old people here. You know, to us, catalog music, like you say, is Michael Jackson's Thriller. If not, that's even, you know, not even catalog. Like, you can go beyond that. I mean, 18 months?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, that number was just kind of thrown out of the air by Billboard magazine. I mean, Billboard loves to work with the music industry in order to ensure that there are as many potential and possible charts for radio and singles and albums in as many different styles of music and genre, in as many formats. They would probably want to have, you know, a cassette chart. Actually, today, Billboard just announced that they have launched an Afro, it's an Afro pop chart specifically to highlight those songs in the Afro pop world. So Billboard was the one to say, look, you know, in conjunction with the record labels who were probably complaining that the album chart, the Billboard 200 album chart, was filled with Bob Marley, Pink Floyd, The Beatles, The Stones, The Who, Led Zeppelin, Fleetwood Mac. And it was really tough for them to develop new artists when they weren't cracking the charts. They couldn't get radio excited about these songs from these new artists. They couldn't get retail to take more copies of an album if it didn't make a chart. So Billboard and the music industry agreed that 18 months was a really good way to kind of come up with a number of months that maybe radio stuck these new songs into gold rotation, which is maybe they'll just bring it out once a month or so. So, you know, a song that came out in 2019, you're not going to hear it every day like you did on the hit radio station. Maybe you'll hear it once a month. And so the Billboard charts have to reflect that. They have a catalog. Billboard also has a catalog album chart that as soon as you go after 18 months, if your album is still on the top 200, it automatically went to the catalog, but now it doesn't. So, you know, that's where you start to see, actually, if you went on the chart, you would see Pink Floyd, you know, Rumors having 571 weeks. You'd have Bob Marley's Legend still on the chart. Dark Side of the Moon comes on the chart every once in a while. You see Eminem, Kendrick Lamar, all these albums with 500 weeks or more. Journey's Greatest Hits is still in the top 50. So it was a way.
As it should be.
Well, as it should be. Shout out to South Detroit. But what it really is, Windsor. It's a way for the music industry to continually work and justify spending money on growth of their market with new artists, always having new development, new publishing deals to be had. And, you know, right now, the fact is that 200 of the most popular tracks now account for less than 5% of all the total streams. That 3 years ago, that number was about 10, 12%. That means that even when it comes to social media and TikTok and Instagram and Facebook, even if you have a really popular song that's on the Billboard Hot 100, you are probably not even scratching the surface of hitting everybody in America like you used to. And I think that's a bigger issue. I think you can take a look at these numbers and kind of play with it. But I think what it really comes down to is, does even having a hit mean what it did before? Whenever I post about Drake having or extending his number ones on the R&B chart on Billboard, or Drake having, you know, demolished the all-time Billboard Hot 100 song list, invariably I will always get a couple of dozen people on Twitter saying, yeah, 273 songs that made the Billboard Hot 100, I can't name any of them. And I think that's a bigger issue, because I think we're getting to a style and a kind in human existence where the really popular stuff isn't really as popular as it used to be. And I think that's going to change the way that the industry takes a look at things too.
Now, I had a question from what you said earlier on, because all these companies, or very few companies, are buying all this music, all these catalogs. Do the charts represent what people actually want to hear? Does radio represent what people want to hear? Or does it represent what these companies want to be played?
I think it's probably the latter. I mean, we've certainly seen a lot of consolidation across North America here in Canada with Bell, Rogers and Shaw, consolidating as much ownership as possible. So what you hear on a pop radio station in Vancouver is exactly what you would hear in the afternoon drive in Calgary, Edmonton, Victoria, Vancouver, Toronto, Halifax, Montreal, because it's almost the same ownership. So it's kind of going, I think maybe the first time I was on this show all those years ago, I think we were talking about radio, and I really remember saying, like, we're all going to go in the way of the BBC, which is there's going to be like four different channels, and that's really going to be it. There's going to be a hot AC, an AC, and a rock, and a light AC or country, and that's it. And whatever city you're in Canada, you're going to hear the exact same music wherever you are. There's no more localization really anymore. And we've certainly seen that in the States. So what people want to hear might be completely different than what that one or two or three people are programming for the entire country. And so, that's a really great question, because I think it kind of falls in the same line as, are people consuming and buying and listening to what they really want to hear? Or are they just getting it fed so much that they don't have a choice because they don't even know what else is out there?
And then you're faced with streaming where you have to choose your own, or you get suggested music.
Right. But it's so overwhelming. I mean, I there are so many people that are older than I am that would love to go on Spotify, and they almost get very scared about going on it for the first time, because it's glorious to, I think, the four of us to know that there's 65 million songs on Spotify, every song we could possibly ever want. I know that you three can probably come up with a couple that aren't on there, much to your chagrin, but yes. The ability, like, what on earth do you listen to? And if you haven't bought an album, a new album, since maybe you were 33, and you're 50 now, what on earth do you listen to? Like, where do you even go when most of the rock stations are playing one new song an hour mixed with The Who and The Cult and Journey and all that stuff? So I think it's not even a problem anymore. It's not even an issue to me that catalog sales have taken over new stuff. It just seems like this is what it is. How do we all kind of work on this when you're a new artist now?
It's also, I wonder, because everything is so fragmented, at one time in Toronto, there was like really two rock and roll stations on AM. There was like Chum and CFTR. And basically those are the two rock stations.
And 40 Chum and yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's basically what everyone listened to. And that kind of allowed, new stuff, because you'd be hearing like new songs once an hour, and you would get to know them. And then you'd go into a record store and all those new releases would be the first thing that you hit.
Right. Yeah. And look, you could call up the radio station back then and they would play something that you would want, and if you got a really crazy DJ on the air, like we had in Toronto, I mean, we were kind of blessed having a lot of really larger than life characters. They play the same song again, just because they could. Like, I remember hearing like Duran Duran, like almost like they promised and threatened a Duran Duran song every hour. And then they would just play the Reflex again because they knew that they were the station of Duran Duran. Like, you could never get that right now. They would say, but look at what, and I'm sure that, you guys have talked about this and thought about this as well. Like, seemingly every once a year, there's always a big story coming out of the incredibly low percentage of women on country music radio. Mm-hmm. Now, is it because that there's no great music that is put out by women? Of course not. So who gets to dictate that? And who's telling you that? Because if you talk to the music directors at these country music stations, they will give you research this high saying women don't want to listen to women on country radio, and men sometimes don't want to listen to two or more women songs. And then seemingly that's a horrible thing to say, because on paper it sounds awful. But if they can back it up with research, well, that's their job, is to keep people listening until commercials. So it's you know, you have this issue, and then you have a whole bunch of other issues, and you're like, okay, so now what do we do? Like, do we just now, you know, going back to the whole, if you are a publishing company, or if you're a venture capitalist who happens to own a lot of older materials, do you start to spend a lot of money after TikTok influencers trying to get a Buddy Holly song to go viral instead of, you know, maybe the next 18-year-old pop star? Like, that's going to be interesting to me, is how much does, or when does the music industry in general start hitting the button on things? A couple of, I don't even know when this was, 7 months ago, 8 months ago, it seemed like Stan Rogers was blowing up and going viral because all of these TikTokers were singing work songs and singing sea shanties. I know at one of the labels that has a lot of those sea shanties hit the button on spending a lot of money pushing that out there. You know, once they knew it was kind of hitting on its own, they were like, well, we should capitalize on this. That money could now not be going to somebody that's new in terms of development. So I don't know.
For a new artist, is it all doom and gloom, or is it because the industry has changed and the way that people consume music, artists have to change the way that they reach out with their, you know, with their new songs.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's never been an easier time to get your music heard. That's for sure. I mean, even with, you know, $10 or $15 or $20 boosting a post on TikTok or Instagram or Facebook, you can reach 2,000 people within your community. You can find like-minded artists and their fans and go after them. In the olden days, that was next to impossible. If you didn't get your video played on Much Music back in the day, you were screwed. You couldn't, there's no other opportunity for you unless you decide to play the country coast to coast to coast to coast. Now, you don't even need to play live. You don't even need to go outside of your house. You have the ability to do your song. You can do remixes. You can do collaborations. You can do the instrumental version. You can do the a cappella version. You can have all sorts of different versions of that song and promote it and boost those posts to those people that are out there without even having touched the industry, finding your own little niche. If you want to elevate that, if you want to go and find that record label or find that management company, it's never really been easier for them to pick out those artists and hopefully lessen their losses. The amount of data that these record labels and management companies and booking agents have right now, I mean, they can look at who is streaming more than a million songs in the city of Toronto in the last 48 hours that's on an independent record label, and just start having their A&R department offering contracts to them. They don't have to go based on gut feeling anymore. So the old adage of, well, for every 10 releases that the major labels release, 7 would lose money, 2 would break even, and 1 release would pay enough for all of their 7 losses, you could seemingly not be batting 100% anymore. You could be very well be batting 700, 800% in having the market dictate where you should be spending your money. And I think that's glorious. So I think if you're a brand new artist, the tools are there for you. You just have to not really be sad that you can't just be an artist anymore. You have to be a publicist and a marketer and a booking agent and a manager and a social media marketing. Like, it's endless job tasks, which I don't envy anybody that wants to get in this business anymore.
Yeah. And being a hit doesn't probably make you as much money as it used to either.
No. It depends. Yes. I mean, if you're going to get a million streamed at 0.0043 cents and you're going to make $4,000, that's not a lot of money. But if I were to tell you that I can get you on a radio station that has a million listeners and you're going to make 2 cents off of that song, you're actually making more money streaming it. I mean, it's kind of apples and oranges, because a million people are actually choosing to play your song rather than a million people listening to it by force on a radio station. So yeah, but I think that was the dirty little secret of the music industry in general. It was not a lot of artists were making a lot of money anyway. They could certainly make enough money, I think, to survive. And by selling CDs off the stage or cassettes or merchandise playing on the weekend. But there were also a lot of bands like that. At least you could have a shot. Now, I don't know. I don't know anymore. But I certainly don't hear the top 1% complain ever. But I never heard the top 1% complain ever anyway. I think that that's just getting that triangle at the top of that 1%. I think the middle is getting really, really large. And that middle is very close to the barely surviving, if that, part of it. You know, I think there was something like 98.8% of all the music on Spotify have not been listened to more than 100 times. And I think those numbers are pretty accurate when it comes to YouTube as well. Because after you go to your parents and your friends and your family, how on earth do you get anybody else to listen?
Yeah. You know? This whole question about like back in the day, you just had to listen to...
I'm just getting depressed. I'm just leaving this whole thing.
like back in the day, you had like Flo was saying, like a choice of three radio stations and, you know, rock A, rock B, or rock C. Like that was pretty much it. Now it's all splintered. But what happens the first time you go on Spotify? What by default, knowing that Spotify knows nothing about your listening habits, what do they feed you? Is it basically what the record labels want you to hear? Is it
maybe
what happens to be top 40 on the radio? Is that what they feed you? I mean, I've been using Spotify for several years now. It's really, really, the algorithm knows me better, knows my music taste better than I know my music taste.
Oh, we all know your music taste, and we're and we're very embarrassed for you.
journey till the end. you know what I mean? Like if I hit the Friday new releases, they're all artists that I follow. They're all artists that I know, and those are my peeps, right?
That's
my thing. And my daily playlist, like I dig those playlists because they're geared towards my taste, and I hear new songs by new artists that I like. But I'm curious, like for someone who's not invested in that way and makes their own playlists and all that sort of stuff, they just go on their Spotify for the very first time and Spotify knows nothing about them. What do they get?
Most people will just encounter a technology and just sort of take whatever it gives them. Like most people don't explore technology. They wouldn't sort of, you know, and what they would probably do is actually go and listen to their old stuff. And actually the older generation has discovered streaming over the last year. And that's one of the reasons why the numbers have gone up.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why it's skewed a little bit. But another question I'm wondering is, you know, is there going to be another Duran Duran? Is there going to be another, you know, Police, a huge band that has that stuff that becomes catalog music?
Well, is Drake, Adele, Taylor Swift, are they comparable?
I think BTS.
BTS, are they comparable? Is that the same level as Michael Jackson was in 1983?
Maybe not the same level as Michael Jackson, but I think that they are absolutely what we would consider Duran Duran. I mean, they just had their live concert across North America being seen in movie theaters, completely shattered the one day gross revenue for music. They had something like $6.5 million spent at the box office, which demolished every other music movie out there when it came to the live concert avenue. We just may not think of that because we're not really in that world, you know? But my parents didn't know about Duran Duran or Culture Club or the Eurythmics or Soft Cell or the Police. They didn't really know that stuff. But I think what changed, though, was somewhere along the line, and I think you can blame or thank the Walkman or the iPod or just generational, somewhere along the line, we parents thought that it would be cool of them to send the music down to the next generation. Somewhere along the line, when I was growing up, there was no way that I would be listening to what my parents were listening to. I saw what they were listening to. My parents actually happened to be very cool, but I didn't know that at the time. I was like, no, I don't want your Motown. I've got my, you know, like this. And so somewhere we stopped, and I hate to say it, we stopped. Parents stopped playing their kids Strawberry Shortcake, Sesame Street, The Wiggles, Barney, all of that stuff, kids' music, and immediately turned them on to the Beach Boys, the Ramones, the Beatles, and the music that they grew up listening to.
Metallica for four-year-olds.
Metallica. Like, the biggest line is, like, it's mini pop kids. It's kids bop. It's like the piano music with Metallica and Ed Sheeran. Somewhere in the last 20, 25 years, we've kind of allowed our kids to like the same music that we do and vice versa, because it was never cool to like your parents' music. Now you go to a Fleetwood Mac show or a Pink show or a BTS show and or Justin Bieber, there are moms that are screaming just as loud, if not louder, at this guy than their daughters are. So I think that there's something to be said for this generation of 8 to 18 year olds not solely thinking that it is uncool to only listen to their music, that whether it's the Batman using Nirvana songs or Marvel superhero movies having Traffic in their soundtrack. It never used to be like that. We used to watch Pretty in Pink and it would be Psychedelic Furs and Talk Talk and Duran Duran and Kate Bush. And it would be only new songs. Now you'd be really hard pressed to find a soundtrack. First of all, you'd be really hard pressed to find a soundtrack, period. But you would be hard pressed to find a soundtrack that doesn't have some sort of nostalgia factor tied into it.
Like Guardians of the Galaxy, it had all these 70s hits.
It was a plot point.
The lead character's mother had left him a cassette of 70s music, right?
But see, now if you're having a movie, and I know we're going all over the map here. So let's say that you're making the next Guardian of the Galaxy. What's in it for you to use nothing but 60s and 70s music? You're not selling a soundtrack anymore. You're really riding on the coattails of Fleetwood Mac and, you know, all of the songs that are being used. You know, the Batman using Nirvana as a really big part of the movie helps Nirvana out as much as it helps out Batman and the DC series, because it's
provided
got that
they
coolness
own
for both.
Their music at this point. Like if Warner Brothers makes a movie and puts Warner Brothers music in it, they're the ones that are profiting from it.
There you go. Right? We used to do that at the labels where some of the movies that the company would be putting out would be really hard pressed to use music that wasn't on the label already, because it would be like, why do we want Universal or Sony, you know?
Yeah, years ago I did a pilot for a teen drama series that was being sponsored by Warner Brothers, and the caveat was you can use anything from our catalog, but it has to all be, you know, like the soundtrack has to all be Warner artists.
Yeah And it's also weird, you know, like, I mean, let's face it, like, your average person after the age of 35, 33 tends to not listen to that much music anymore anyway. You know, they have kids, they got married, they have a mortgage, they have a job, they're taking the bus, they're taking the subway, where maybe, you know, music really isn't a factor. They're still listening to the same stuff. And especially in the last 2 years where we've kind of, you know, as much as Netflix can always proclaim that, well, look at all of the amazing new series that are blowing up. And certainly the music industry can look at Olivia Rodrigo and the new Adele album and the new BTS and all sorts of new Megan Thee Stallion and all these brand new artists. For the most part, I would probably think that we're just looking for comfort. You know, we're looking for music that got us through the last two and a half years of familiarity and comfort levels. So we are going back to maybe Adele, but maybe we're going back to the first album. Maybe Adele sold 17 million copies of her new album, but is it really touching people like her first couple of albums did? I'm not so sure. I guess only time will tell for that.
I have a question because I thought it was interesting what you said about the generation that exists now of younger people were raised by their parents to listen to, you know, good music or at least, you know, adult music as opposed to being given kiddie music. So they go, oh, I like that Fleetwood Mac song, or I like the Beatles song or the Nirvana song or whatever era of their parents' music they're into. So have they created a young audience who don't care to listen to new music necessarily, whereas we all didn't want to listen to our parents' music. We were hungry for something new. What's the new sound? But perhaps like the audience now that should have been only listening to new music has been raised in a way that they don't necessarily need that because they have the catalog. Listen to Greta Van Fleet when you can listen to Led Zeppelin.
You know what? It's an excellent point. Why even search out the 110 new artists out there to find the one really good one when it's proven that these 40 artists that are always on the Rolling Stones best vocalist or best bands or best albums of all time are already proven to you? You know, there's status there. You know, the other thing is, as well, is, you know, when we were growing up, we were all, you know, I get the feeling like we're all the same age. We're all in our mid-30s. The ability to claim nostalgia and say, yeah, I listen to oldies. Man, that was like 1940, 1950. Elvis was still alive when I was alive. You know, I kind of knew about him, but I certainly wasn't. I was listening to some of his older stuff, but like listening to music from 30 years ago in 1985 would be me listening to Ricky Nelson from 1955 back then. It just didn't happen. Now, you talk about 35 years ago, and I seemingly think 35 years ago is like 2010, but it's not. Like, these kids are still buying Nirvana and Soundgarden and everything. And I think part of it is just the accessibility of it. We don't have to save up $35 to go buy that album and hope that it's there. It's right there in our fingertips. And these artists are still alive. They're not dying. Paul McCartney, you want to go see Paul McCartney? You can see him. You want to go see Elton John? You can see him. There was nothing really cool about seeing somebody from 1950 in the 1980s. Now it kind of is. And I think we've all celebrated those artists because we're still here, and the generation, whatever generation you're in, always, always says that their music and their books and their film and their TV is better than anybody else's out there.
Some people have, I know we're definitely going to get people
I'm generalizing too. my daughter will always be listening for the rest of her life. She's 18. She will always have Olivia Rodrigo in her life. Always, 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 because that was the artist, that's the biggest artist in her of her generation. So will she get into the Beatles? Yeah, she's slowly getting into classic rock and stuff like that. But, you know, it was harder than I thought. You know, I felt like I failed a lot of times because she just wasn't getting into it. And she would be liking Bieber and Drake and all that stuff. And I was like, okay, that's okay. Eventually she'll come over to the dark side, and slowly she is.
Yeah. I remember sitting down with my son and having explained to me this trap music. What the hell?
Right. Right.
Is it everything built on triplets? God.
But it's also in the way that we're consuming it as well, too. You know, if you're a teenager and you're getting all your music based on TikTok, you're really only hearing 30 seconds of something. And that's not a knock against the listening devices. That's just the way that the concept of music is used there. It's using it as in the background to creating a dance or creating a very funny video. It's not looking at your older brother and sister, wondering what they're listening to, wanting to be like the cool kids, saving your money, taking a bus, going through that first section of the record store in the new release section, hoping that they have it, reading, you know, buying it, taking it home, unwrapping it, all the things that we have talked about ad nauseum about buying a vinyl record. it's the experience of it. And more importantly, you didn't own anything else unless you saved up enough money to buy something else. So you were stuck with that record. And so it's not just flipping through 4 seconds and you've got 5 seconds to win me over. You know, Michael asks, and it's such a good point, you know, like, is it sad when you're a new artist and is it tougher? Yeah, because it's almost like if you don't get to the chorus in 15 seconds, you may not actually have an audience that will help get there.
A lot of people will be asking also whether it's the quality of the songs. People are saying that a lot of modern songs aren't terribly memorable just by the way they happen to be written, which is often by committee and, you know, sometimes, you know, almost too formulaic. And I don't know if that's true or not. It's you know, one of those, all those kids in their songs sound as good as...
I mean, there was Tin Pan Alley, there was the Brill Building, there was, you know, there have been committee songwriting forever.
I will tell you, I'll leave my own personal opinion out of it. I don't, there's a lot of stuff that I love. I think Billie Eilish is great. I think Olivia Rodrigo is great. There are a lot of older artists that have told me that their choruses that they hear on the radio today wouldn't even make it as a bridge in their song.
Yeah.
There is no way that some of the stuff that they're listening to would even make it past the committee of the Brill Building, because it was like your verses had to be choruses, your choruses had to be double choruses, and your verses were likely a chorus from another song that you couldn't finish by deadline. You know? So I will defer to them. But the art of songwriting means something different to everybody in every generation, in every culture.
Well, that is true. And I know one of the articles that we'll link to in our show notes talks about one of the issues that a lot of companies are nervous about listening to demo tapes, because, you know, they could get sued in 8 years. So it's almost impossible to get your new music to be heard by people, because it's so risky for the companies to actually hear new music, because they could get sued in 8 years. The blurred lines decision really changed things.
Yeah. And it was also the ability that you could now have, you know, again, because people can access every single song that's ever written somewhere, whether through YouTube or not, the ability to, for somebody halfway around the world with barely an internet connection, can make as much noise in the media when they decide to sue Katy Perry is astounding, because you would never hear about these cases 20 years ago. They would all be done very, very quietly. Or that artist who thinks that their song got ripped off would just walk away in frustration, because they would have no idea how to get a hold of Katy Perry and her people, or the Blurred Lines writer, or Ed Sheeran. Or it seems like every day there's a new plagiarism charge against these songs. And I don't think that they're running out of songs. I think it's just so much easier for somebody to complain and hear music when we all have access to every single radio station on the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. What I've been finding is that a lot of the new artists that I like, and even a lot of the new artists that are even big, like your Taylor Swift's and all the guys, they're kind of harking back to that old school music to a certain extent, you know, like they're kind of writing songs in the way that they used to. Like Billie Eilish is maybe the exception to the rule, where she's really pushing something new and different and truly, truly modern. In that sense. But a lot of the songs, like I'm loving the new Tears for Fears album. Like it's fantastic, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like a lot of the music that I like today, even if they're new artists or if they're older artists coming back, then it's kind of, you know, like you say, it's like harking back to, you know, when I was in my 20s, 30s, and it's reminding me of something back then that I think is good.
Yeah. Yeah. Does the art of songwriting change when it is by committee? Because you would think,
and
you know, if you've got,
I think you make a blanket statement either.
Yeah, I mean, like if you've got 8 people writing a song, like wouldn't you just think, is that coming from me? I'm hearing music.
No. We're being played out. We're almost running out of time.
Is that the wrap up? Okay, yes or no? Wouldn't you think that if you got 8 people writing a song, they would each come with just a bang up, like 8 bars, and every song would so hit, but it doesn't.
No, that would be schizophrenic.
Hard to do things with committees.
Yeah. Right, right.
As a general rule, no, but yeah, it's not.
Yeah.
But building and stuff like that.
I just get the feeling like with talking to you guys, with Phil and Neil and Michael, that you three are as big of a committee as you ever want in your whole life.
Yeah.
Just you three.
Yeah.
Thinking we should do a show in the future about our favorite songs written by 8 people.
That's true. Well, I do have a blanket statement to make, and that means the band is wanting to go home. That means it's all the time we have today on Song Talk Radio. Eric, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks,
you
guys.
Are
I'm
awesome.
Happy to,
Eric. As always.
Happy to be here. I'm sorry that I didn't let you guys get in a word, Edward. They can find me at that Eric Alper.
That's the point.
Type in Eric Alper at Google. You'll find me.
He is everywhere.
Enough.
Don't forget, we want to really hear from you, the listener. So why don't you send us an email to feedback?
I don't want to hear from anybody. No. I don't care what anybody else's opinion is. Don't come at me. I don't care what you have to say. Go bug Neil. Neil wants to know what you
Neil
have to
wants
say.
To everything. Yeah. Send all your men.
Don't ignore it all.
Send all your complaints to Neil. Anyways, so send us an email, feedback at songtalk.ca with any questions or comments on this particular topic. We'd love to hear from you. Your emails make us very happy. We do read everyone. And don't forget, you can always join us for the next Song Talk Meetup. Free to join on meetup.com and free to attend. So stop by the website for that information. And don't forget about our next songwriting challenge. We want to hear from you. And if you're listening to us on YouTube, you better have subscribed, because I know where you live. Anyways, if you want to get more from Neil,
at least your IP address.
That's true. Neil, how do we get more of you?
At neilmodi.com.
And how about you, Michael?
I don't have anything new, so no, I don't want to be
followed
right now.
What have you been doing during this whole pandemic? Go get yourself a website. GeoCities,
I don't have anything new either, but I got lots of catalog stuff.
That's true.
Michael, go to geocities.com.
Go to my first website. That was my website way back.
Yeah, that doesn't make us sound old at all. Don't forget to
AOL.com.
MikeBass.com / Michael Proudfoot. Maybe you can be one of his 8 friends. Okay, I'll shut up now.
Okay, we got to stop drinking during the show. Don't forget, you can find the links to all the products, books, and web services we mentioned here on the show on the resources page and wherever you are. Don't forget to join us on the next Zoom Song Talk Meetup. Free to attend on meetup.com. And that's about all we have for today. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. And keep on running, everyone.
So long.
Good night.